Welcome to Colorectal Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Eric von Kutsum from the University Hospital Gasthuisberg in Leuven, Belgium. And to begin, I asked him about biomarker evaluation for patients with metastatic colorectal cancer who are being considered for first-line systemic therapy. In your mind, when you see a patient who you're evaluating for first-line therapy for metastatic colorectal cancer, what do you consider, you know, the minimum in terms of biomarker workup?
When I see a patient, I want in the initial start to have three biomarkers. I want to know the complete RAS analysis, not only KRAS exon 2, but complete RAS analysis, KRAS exon 2, 3, 4, and NRAS analysis. I want to know something about the BRAF mutation status, because that may influence also. And then I want to know the information on MSI. Although, if we are honest, in first-line treatment, we usually don't start with a checkpoint inhibitor in first-line, even in MSI patients. But I want to know it for sure in my patients, RAS, BRAF, MSI, and then maybe not at the initial stage, but during the course of treatment, I order always a HER2 amplification, because there are some, especially on the left side, especially in RAS wild-type patients, 3 to 5% of patients have an HER2 amplification, and they may benefit also from combinations of HER2 targeting agents. So these four classes of markers I want to know: RAS, BRAF, MSI, MSS, and HER2.
Can you talk about more specifically what type of assay you prefer in these situations? And to what extent liquid biopsies are starting to enter the arena?
We do in our patients an NGS panel, and this NGS, RAS and BRAF and MSI, that's all included in this type of analysis. We do it on tumor samples. Liquid biopsies is entering, but not so much, let's say, the oncology practices in Europe neither. It will change, it will become relevant, but it's going to take a couple of years more. There are some, let's say, centers who focus a lot on clinical research, a lot on trials, who do it in a systematic way. We start to collect also the samples, but we don't base our decisions on liquid biopsies. Today, we still do it on the tumor samples.
So you said that you do NGS. For a doc in practice, is that what you recommend? And what about one-off testing? You know, testing individually, just MSI, just BRAF, just RAS.
Yeah, today the NGS panels, it's much cheaper. If you ask it, you have all the information, you can see the whole strategy. If you ask for a RAS test, and then later, and if the patient is RAS wild type, and then you need to know BRAF, so you lose so much time, so it's much cheaper. And there are big differences also in the US and Europe. We have now in Leuven, in my hospital, implemented a 95-gene panel, which is composed and done in our hospital. And that costs just over €400, so $500, which is a big difference with the big panels, the commercial panels in the US.
I want to go through, you know, some of your thinking as it relates to the subsets that are created based on these biomarkers and management in terms of, you know, specifically how you approach it. I am curious, though, you know, starting to hear, you know, the whole concept of basket approach to therapy. Are there any, you know, rare abnormalities that you might be thinking about, particularly, you know, maybe farther down the line that you might want to be considering? And one I never thought to ask, because now we're seeing people test for BRCA and pancreatic cancer and prostate cancer. What about BRCA and colorectal cancer?
BRCA and colorectal cancer, I don't have a good idea how frequent it is, but it happens also. BRCA patients, germline BRCA mutant patients, they have a slightly higher chance of colorectal cancer, on top especially also, of course, of breast cancer and pancreatic cancer. BRCA, we don't, however, on the other side, we don't take our clinical decisions in BRCA patients if they have a germline or a somatic mutation. That doesn't influence our clinical practice yet today in colorectal cancer. But with these NGS panels, on top of the four tests I want to know, with these NGS panels, you can look Pol-E, Pol-D mutations, track alterations. They're all rare. Nobody has an excellent idea, perfect idea on the frequency, but they're all probably in around 1%. But some of these, let's say, alterations or mutations may be targetable, also druggable in the future. Pol-E, Pol-D, probably with a checkpoint inhibitor. There are now some track inhibitors. So this segmenting, and that is becoming more important. Of course, for sure, in Europe, that's not yet approved therapy. So that's why in community practice, we cannot make yet today strong recommendations that we should look at all these different rare alterations. But I'm convinced that if we're looking down the road within 2-3 years, that these different alterations or mutations will become more and more relevant, and that we will, and that they will have practical therapeutic implications for the patients in the future.
So again, just to not to get too far off the topic, but you said you wouldn't treat a patient with a BRCA germline mutation any differently. So you wouldn't consider a PARP inhibitor in a patient with a BRCA germline mutation, a colorectal cancer who ran out of options?
I don't have any data to say that. In Europe, we couldn't draw, let's say in my country, no trials in my center, no trials open. And in this situation for PARP inhibitors, we are not allowed to use them off-label. So we have to stick for these indications to the label. If you would ask me, regardless of the label, whether I would do it, if we're out of options in a patient with a BRCA mutation, the answer would be yes, I could consider that. If you would then ask me, what is the chance of having some responses and some activity? I don't have a good answer to that question. I would love to see a little bit more data, a cohort of patients, non-randomized, but a cohort of patients where you can say, okay, there's 1/3 of patients who will have a response or whatever is the number, but at least that we have a little bit more confidence. That may sound conservative, but we don't have any data in this group of patients.
No, it sounds like it makes a lot of sense, actually. So one other issue I just want to layer in here before we start diving into pretty much how you treat patients is the issue of sidedness, left versus right-sided tumors. Could you kind of give a summary on where we are today and understanding that issue? A lot of different metabolic pathways, et cetera. Maybe you can talk a little about your vision about sort of the left and right side issues.
I've paid a lot of attention to that, and I went in depth to the sidedness because I do believe that this is a relevant parameter. Sidedness is clearly prognostic. Patients with a right-sided tumor have a clearly worse prognosis than patients with a left-sided tumor. But on top of being prognostic, it's also predictive. It means that it helps us to tell us something about the therapeutic options. Left-sided tumors, they really have a better response to a chemo doublet plus an anti-EGFR antibody compared to chemo plus bevacizumab when the tumor is located on the left side. We're speaking on the RAS wild type patients. While on the right side, that's clearly not the case. On the right side, EGFR inhibitors have no clear benefit. On the right side, there is a bit more benefit from chemo plus bevacizumab. So in our algorithm, in looking what we should do for a patient, this sidedness plays a role in the RAS wild-type patients, at least. Not in the RAS mutant patients, but in the RAS wild-type patients. If they are on the left side, if the patient has a lot of symptoms and we want to reduce the symptoms, if the patient has a biology that is a bit faster under evolution, or if the patient has a big tumor burden that we want to shrink to downsize the tumor burden, then we will choose a doublet plus an EGFR inhibitor when the primary tumor is located on the left side. When the primary tumor is located on the right side, I never do that. I always start with the chemo doublet, FOLFOX usually, plus bevacizumab. Also, if the goal is, or if these patients have a faster biology, speaking on RAS wild type and RAF wild type metastasis tumor again. So always with the chemo doublet plus bevacizumab. Also, if we want to shrink the metastasis, that's what we usually do. Occasionally, we may go on the right side if we want really to shrink the tumor in order to make it resectable with a triplet, FOLFOXIRI plus bevacizumab. But on the right side, I will never start with an EGFR inhibitor. While in Europe, and that's, we have translated that also in the ESMO guidelines, in Europe, we usually start, and that's what I often do also, on the left side with an EGFR antibody, especially if the goal is to control aggressive tumor biology, to control symptoms, or if we want to shrink that. Of course, in every patient, you have always to discuss this, and the skin toxicity may be an issue to the patients, but you have to explain it. And there are some patients who then choose not to do it. But I really do think that this influences, and that's what we have translated in the guidelines also.
So just to clarify, though, again, RAS wild type right side, do you end up using EGFR antibodies second or third line?
Yes, these data are only in first line, what I was saying. So the data and the different analysis on sidedness don't exclude the EGFR antibody in the right side, in a RAS wild type tumor, in second or third line. There we still do it, of course. There are no data that tell us that we should not do it. Yes, but I was speaking in the first line, there is this clear distinction.
And just to clarify about the left-sided tumors, first of all, in terms of the benefit, the over using an EGFR antibody over bevacizumab, to me, it looks like it's fairly modest. I see maybe hazard rates around 0.75 for progression-free survival, you know, kind of a modest but not huge benefit. Is that sort of globally the way you look at it, or do you think the benefit is greater?
The benefit is clearly there, but that's in, if you look at different trials in colorectal cancer in all different settings, if you see a benefit of a hazard ratio of 0.75 or 0.70, the way you look at it, it's modest, but it's a clear benefit that is there. And if you look at the strategy in these patients, starting first with an EGFR inhibitor on the left side, RAS wild type, and then later integrating bevacizumab versus the other sequence around on the left side, first bevacizumab and then an anti-EGFR antibody, the difference in survival, we are not speaking of 2-3 months, there is a bigger difference in survival.
So if you look at the progression-free survival, what I would call 2, which would be the time from the beginning of first-line therapy to the time of progression on second-line therapy, the two combined, is that greater if you start with an EGFR antibody and then go to Bev?
That's correct. That is what is shown in the different studies. If you look into detail in the sidedness data, yes, that is shown. And that's why practice is completely shifting in my center, but also in most European countries. And that's why it's also implemented in ESMO guidelines in this situation.
So let's talk a little bit more about how you approach the KRAS wild-type patient in terms of sequencing of therapies.
In the RAS wild-type patients, the sequence of therapy, if it's located on the right side, even a RAS wild-type patients, we will start usually with FOLFOX bevacizumab. We're speaking on non-resectable patients, but even the borderline resectable, we will usually start with FOLFOX bevacizumab when the primary tumor is on the right side in a RAS wild-type tumor. If the patient is progressive, in second line, we will switch, of course, to FOLFIRI. But then it's going to depend. In most patients, I will then continue with BEV, bevacizumab, post-progression. So FOLFIRI, bevacizumab. If the patient has a very fast progression on first line, on FOLFOX, BEV, and 2 months after the start, he was progressive, and he's RAS wild type, he's BRAF wild type. Then in second line, we may go either to FOLFIRI plus aflibercept, either FOLFIRI plus an EGFR antibody. Because in this scenario, there was a fast progression on FOLFOX bevacizumab in the first line. But that's only in a minority of patients. The majority don't have this fast progression. They have progression after 4, 6, 8, 12 months or later on. So we start with FOLFOX bev in the majority of patients. Take off oxaliplatin after 4 to 6 months, depending when they start to develop neuropathy. If there is no progression, go on with maintenance treatment with 5-FU-BEV. And then later, if there is progression, depending on whether the patient had neuropathy, reintroduce again oxaliplatin, so the stop-and-go strategy that was developed by Emery de Grammont, or if he still had neuropathy, he or she had still had neuropathy at the moment of progression on the maintenance treatment, then introduce FOLFIRI and probably continue bevacizumab in this scenario to reserve the EGFR antibody for third line and not integrate it in the second line. Because the benefit, the relative benefit of an EGFR antibody in this scenario is clearly at least as high in third line than is it in second line. And then you have an extra line in the continuum of care. So FOLFOX, BEV, FOLFIRI, BEV, and then irinotecan plus an EGFR antibody, irinotecan plus cetuximab.
And when you use FOLFIRI, BEV as your second line therapy, when you do bring in the EGFR antibody, do you add anything to it?
Usually I add irinotecan-based chemotherapy. This may be irinotecan alone, or this may be still FOLFIRI plus cetuximab or panitumumab. Because if you go back to the BOND study, we published, David Cunningham and myself, we published that in 2005 in the New England Journal of Medicine. This was a randomized study in pretreated patients, irinotecan refractory, that we randomized between cetuximab or cetuximab irinotecan. And the chances of response was double as high in irinotecan cetuximab compared to cetuximab alone, even if they were irinotecan refractory. So that's why if patients are coping with the toxicity of irinotecan-based therapy, we will combine irinotecan-based therapy with cetuximab. If a patient, of course, is telling me, I don't want any chemotherapy anymore, or if he was suffering at that moment a lot from mucositis or 5-FU-related toxicity, then I will not give him FOLFIRI, then I may give him irinotecan cetuximab, or even take out the irinotecan also. Try to understand what was the toxicity that the patient had before.
What about the left-sided RAS wild-type tumors? What's your sequence there?
Left-sided, the sequence is slightly different. In left-sided tumors, many patients will start with FOLFOX plus an EGFR antibody. Second line may, if they are progressive, then they will switch to FOLFIRI plus bevacizumab. Not all patients will start with FOLFOX cetuximab or an EGFR antibody, but a lot will start. Those who will not start are the patients who don't want, after discussion, skin toxicity in the first line. The second group may be the elderly patients not willing a combination treatment, combination cytotoxic. That's in my practice only a low number of patients. That you may start with an elderly patient with tiny small lung metastasis and a few small liver metastasis, not resectable, never resectable. You may start this patient with capecitabine or 5-FU bevacizumab, not a doublet. But in our practice, that's only a small number of patients. In some countries, it's up to 20-25% of the patients in this group of patients. So that's a group of patients. I will not start with an EGFR antibody. I will start with just a fluoropyrimidine plus bevacizumab. And the second group of patients that I will not start with an EGFR antibody on the left side, RAS wild type patients, are patients with a rather indolent disease that we still want to start with a doublet. Patients with 10 small lung metastases, 10 small liver metastases, but very small. We know that these metastases are there already since 6 months for one or another reason, and we may want to treat them right now, but they are asymptomatic, slow evolution, never resectable. That's a group of patients that I may start still with a doublet FOLFOX plus bevacizumab. But in the other group of patients, those where we want to shrink the metastasis because the heavy tumor burden with a rapid biology, or those that we want to shrink the metastasis because we think that potentially the metastasis may become resectable, I will always start with a doublet plus an EGFR antibody.
So what about the KRAS mutant patient, right and left-sided? Again, can you kind of go through how you sequence in those situations?
In the RAS mutant patients, there is no clear difference. The sidedness data they apply only for the RAS wild type patients. So, of course, in RAS mutant patients, we will never use an EGFR antibody. So in this group of patients, we start with FOLFOX bevacizumab as well on the right side as on the left side. And then in the second line, we will switch to FOLFIRI plus usually bevacizumab, occasionally aflibercept. If there was a very fast progression on the first line, FOLFOX bevacizumab, then we may change after 2 months to FOLFIRI aflibercept. But if the progression is not so fast, if it's after 4-6 months or longer, then we will start in second line always FOLFIRI bevacizumab.
So let's layer in the issue of patients with BRAF mutant disease. Can you again talk about how you sequence agents in that situation and whether it's different right and left sided?
In the BRAF mutant patients, there is no clear difference left and right side. Because BRAF mutant patients, we will today not treat them with an EGFR antibody in combination with chemotherapy in the BRAF mutant patients. There are two options in the first line in BRAF mutant patients. That's either if they have an aggressive behavior, and if we know the day that we start the chemotherapy that they have a BRAF mutation, then with a very aggressive behavior, young age, good condition, then we may start with FOLFOXIRI bevacizumab. If they are a bit more frail, a bit borderline performance, then we will start with FOLFOX bevacizumab in this group of patients. And then in the second line, if a BRAF mutant patient is progressive on his first line treatment, then we will try to implement in the framework of a clinical trial, because the BRAF inhibitor plus a MEK inhibitor plus an EGFR antibody, these combinations are not yet approved in Europe. So we have then to look for a clinical trial. And these trials are now widely spread over different parts in Europe so that we can do that. And at the moment, one of the most promising trials is the trial with encorafenib, binimetinib plus cetuximab, which was recently approved in BRAF mutant melanoma. There is a phase 3 trial running. I presented at ESMO GI the data of the lead-in phase. The first 30 patients in the safety lead-in phase, where there was a response rate that approached 50% and where there was a survival of more than 12 months. So that's promising, and that compares very favorable to what you can reach in this group of patients with historic controls, like in the SWOG data, in the study, for instance, in these BRAF mutant patients with cetuximab plus irinotecan, the numbers are much lower. So this, I know it's a selected group, the safety lead-in phase of this so-called Beacon study that I presented at ESMO GI, but the phase 3 study is now running, and that will end in the near future, that phase 3 study. So that's important. At the moment, we do that in second line. We will, however, start a study soon. It's again a global study. It's a phase 2 study, so it's not randomized, to implement this strategy in the first line. This is a study where we will treat patients in the first line, BRAF mutant, if we are aware of that they have a BRAF mutation, V600, with encorafenib, the MEK inhibitor binimetinib, and the EGFR antibody cetuximab in the first line. When we're speaking of BRAF mutations, it's also important that we clarify that we're speaking of BRAF V600 mutations. There was last year a publication also on the rare subgroup of BRAF V non-600 mutations, which have a completely different behavior than the V600 mutations. So the BRAF mutations is not a homogeneous group. A clinician or a practicing oncologist has really to look into the details. Was this a BRAF V600 mutation, like we see in melanoma, or was this a BRAF non-V600 mutations? The BRAF V600 mutations have a very bad prognosis. The BRAF non-V600 mutations have a good prognosis. And looking at the paper from Scott Kopetz in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, the prognosis of these patients regardless of the treatment, with the BRAF-V non-600 mutation was even a bit better than from a BRAF wild-type patient. So that distinction is important and has also therapeutic implications. We don't know whether we should treat BRAF-V non-600 mutants different as BRAF wild-type. Nobody knows that right now.
Getting back to the encorafenib, binimetinib, EGFR antibody approach, you know, I think I'm hearing from the melanoma people that there's this feeling maybe it's going to be more effective and they think maybe less toxic. You know, it's kind of early for, you know, they're not, it's, I'm not really sure that's actually the case. Obviously, you're encouraged about the activity. What about the tolerability, the toxicity?
We have seen different generations of combinations. Other BRAF inhibitors and MEK inhibitors in combination with an EGFR antibody before this, for instance, the combinations that included dabrafenib and trametinib, these combinations were a bit more toxic. This may also be the learning curve. At that moment, we started with these combinations in colorectal cancer. But now, having seen more patients with these combinations of encorafenib and binitinib plus cetuximab, toxicity is acceptable. Like in any combination, you sometimes see some patients with safety issues. But in general, many patients are able to continue with these treatments. And it seems to be a bit better than the previous combinations, as I just mentioned.
What about fever? You know, when you just use a BRAF inhibitor and a MEK inhibitor together, fever is a common problem. What about with the triplet? Do you see fever?
No, we don't see fever in this situation with this combination. The most frequent toxicity is skin toxicity, but strange enough, it's less frequent than what you see it because this combination contains cetuximab. So it seems that the triplet combination induces less skin toxicity than cetuximab alone. I don't have an explanation for that. With the older MEK inhibitors, we saw a lot more eye toxicity also. With this, we do see it occasionally, but not clinically relevant eye toxicity. What you see sometimes in some patients is that fatigue, a little bit GI toxicity, and also CK, creatine kinase elevations. You see that also with the MEK inhibitor sometimes. But in general, there are at least, we didn't see the full data set yet of the phase 3 study, of course, but looking at the initial data sets with these combinations, encorafenib, binitinib, plus cetuximab, that seems feasible.
So I've asked you a number of times over the years about how you manage the dermatologic toxicity of EGFR antibodies. I'm just kind of curious, well, maybe I can get a little bit of an update. Anything new? How do you approach these patients preemptively and when they do develop toxicity?
In the beginning, we didn't do preemptive treatment. Now we don't do completely preemptive treatment, not at the day we start with cetuximab or panitumab. We don't start with antibiotics, but we are very sensitive. At the initial occurrence of some skin toxicities, we start then with local treatments for the skin on top of antibiotics, minocycline. Most patients get minocycline. And of course, you get used to see the images a bit more. But today, we cope better than what we did 10 years ago, or over 10 years ago, when we started with each of our antibodies. The major problem remains, and therefore we don't have a good management, is the fissures that patients do develop. That's not the first 2-3 months. Fissures at the fingers, at the toes, paronychia after 4, 6, 8 months. And that's sometimes annoying. Patients come in on their sport shoes. They can't wear normal shoes. And then at that moment, you have some patients where you have to give to interrupt the treatment and you stop it. And then you introduce later on, once this is healed, then some patients.
So let's talk a little bit. You mentioned HER2 positive disease. And I'd like to maybe get an update from you of where we are today in terms of, first of all, what we know about how often you see HER2-positive colorectal cancer and what interventions are utilized, but also in terms of diagnostic tests, because I saw that at ASCO, there was a paper presented, I think it was from the original Heracles study, looking at a liquid assay for HER2 amplification and trying to correlate it with benefit. Can you kind of comment on that and the whole issue of HER2-positive colorectal cancer?
Well, HER2-positive colorectal cancer is an important subgroup. We see around 3 to 5% of patients, mainly RAS wild type, who have an HER2 amplification. At the moment, we still look at the tumor biopsies. We look at the FISH test for HER2 amplification in this group of patients, what we do in our center. And that's also based on the pioneers of this subgroup and the treatment, Dr. Siena from Italy and Dr. Bardelli from Italy, who did xenografts and then later did the clinical studies with combination treatment. This was all in amplified tumors. And also this group is now looking also at some liquid biopsies. Alberto Bardelli, who was in the past working with Vogel's team and John Hopkins, he's a pioneer in this marker test and a believer also that liquid biopsies may play a role in this group of patients. But in clinical practice today, for me and the oncologist, practicing oncologist, recommendation is to look into that in patients failing different treatment options. And especially focus that on the left-sided RAS wild-type tumors, because that's the highest chance of finding an HER2-amplified tumor. If the tumor is amplified, HER2-amplified, then the message is not to treat him with one agent. The HERACLES study was a combination of the HER2 antibody trastuzumab plus lapatinib, the TKI. There are some data also on trastuzumab, pertuzumab. There are some further studies ongoing, but it seems that we need to give a doublet of two HER2 blockers based on the tumor analysis, the HER2 amplification. And there, in general, we don't have like very big series, but looking at the studies, the HERACLES study, but also the other studies, we see around 30% of patients having an objective response. So one out of three, which is not spectacular, but which is good. And I have a couple of these patients also with the long-lasting responses, lasting for more than 10 months now, with the combination of trastuzumab, lapatinib, that's what we do. There is no trial open in my center, but we can get the drugs in a so-called compassionate use program available, trastuzumab plus lapatinib. And I have a couple of patients under treatment now for more than 10 months who were progressive on different treatments, FOLFOX, bevacizumab, FOLFIRI, cetuximab, and then we found that they were HER2 positive. We usually implement this strategy of HER2 targeted agents only after they're progressive on the classic standard treatments. But I do that before we implement in these patients regorafenib or trifluridine tipiracil, so that's 102. At that moment, clearly, if the information is not available, I want to know the information on HER2, and HER2 amplification is easy. You can just order that test. I want to know that because if the patients, and the couple of examples that I gave you are patients who are not yet on regorafenib and TAS-102, before they go on these drugs, if they're HER2 amplified, we put them on trastuzumab lapatinib.
What do we know about chemotherapy with anti-HER therapy in colorectal cancer?
We don't know so much. I don't know so much about chemotherapy in combination with anti-HER2 targeted agents. In gastric cancer, of course, we have done the studies with 5-FU or capecitabine, cisplatin, plus trastuzumab. In this group of patients, we don't know because these patients were failing fluoropyrimidines, oxaliplatin, and irinotecan. The pivotal initial small study, the HERACLES study, was in patients failing classic chemotherapy. Personally, I would not do that a trial, let's say in early lines, HER2 positive patients, treat them with chemo or chemo combination with bevacizumab plus an HER2 targeted treatment. I would not do that. I would keep it in the clean, pure situation today.
How about meeting halfway in between with T-DM1?
No experience with T-DM1, to my knowledge, no data with T-DM1 from larger studies. T-DM1 did not show any benefit in gastric or HER2 amplified or positive gastric cancer. In colorectal cancer, we don't have positive data. I don't know exactly what, because in gastric cancer, one of the reasons why T-DM1 was negative is that really the heterogeneous aspect of HER2 positivity in gastric cancer, which may be less an issue in colorectal cancer, but we don't have large series that have been looking into that, to my knowledge.
So you mentioned regorafenib and TAS-102, you know, sort of the second, I guess, not second line, but, you know, after the initial first and second line therapy. Can you comment a little bit? There have been subsequent data sets that have come out with both of these agents that you've been involved with, a number of these papers subsetting out patients, looking at all kinds of variables. Can you talk about, maybe we'll start out with TAS-102, what we've learned about that in the last few years?
Well, TAS-102 is a drug that gives some benefit. It's not a wonder drug. It does not induce responses in patients, but it prolongs the life of some patients. We see in general that around 40% of patients have no fast progression when put on TAS-102. Toxicity is fine. We have learned how to manage toxicity. Toxicity is mainly neutropenia. 30 to 40% of patients develop grade 3-4 neutropenia, with few patients neutropenic infections. The good news, on the other hand, is that the neutropenia is related to activity. And we have published recently some subsets also. Patients with more neutropenia have a longer benefit with TAS-102. TAS-102 in cross-trial comparison seems to be better tolerated than regorafenib, at least at the initial dose, the approved dose of 160 milligrams. But at least looking at trying to distinguish efficacy-wise both drugs, the relative benefit compared to placebo in the initial pivotal studies was similar for regorafenib and TAS-102. But with regorafenib, we saw a bit more patients with long benefit. There were a bit long-lasting benefit. That's shown in some clinical data, also published in some of the subsets. But that's also my honest experience. TAS-102, there are lower number of patients who go on long. I have some patients who are on regorafenib for more than a year, which is not very frequent. That's more exceptional with TAS-102 in this situation. Why this is, I don't know. Nobody knows, but these are what we see, and that's not only me, that's also my other colleagues, experts who see that, and that also is published in some of the data. Looking then at the newer regorafenib data that we have seen on the REDOSE study, and there is now a European similar type of study with some different arms ongoing, from which the European study we don't have yet the data, but that's an important experience for regorafenib, because what we see there, what Tony Saab has published, is that if you start with regorafenib at low dose, 80 milligrams, instead of the approved 160 milligrams, and then after 1 week you go up to 120, and then eventually, if there's no toxicity, you go up to 160 milligrams, more patients, and that was the endpoint of this relatively small study, more patients can be treated, go with cycle 3 and beyond, in the patient starting with the lower dose and the patient starting with the normal dose. And that's important, and that reflects that there is a bit more benefit, that the progression-free survival time was a bit longer in the patients who started with lower dose, 80, then 120, then 160 milligrams. It's also logic to expect that. If you start with 160 milligrams, what we did in the beginning with regorafenib, and then you see too much toxicity, some patients, and these are end-stage patients who have went already through different lines of therapy, they say, doctor, I don't want this anymore. This is too toxic. I want to stop. So more patients stop the drug. And with this drug, which is angiogenesis inhibitor and targets also other tyrosine kinases, it's important that you can keep the patients on treatment. And then you will have a longer benefit. And that's the reason why the data of this REDOSE study presented by Tony Saab at ASCO GI and at ESMO GI, that we see a bit longer benefit with this strategy. Now, looking back to the two drugs, regorafenib and TAS-102, the original data set, cross-trial comparisons, the hazard ratio and the relative benefit for regorafenib and TAS-102 was quite similar. Going then further in a randomized phase 2 study, yeah, we have to stress that, in a randomized phase 2 study, the strategy of starting with the lower dose seems to have more benefit than the normal strategy. it's dangerous to do too many extrapolations, but that's for me an important argument. If patients are fit and can cope the two different drugs, I may start with regorafenib at a lower dose, because then they can have later on TAS-102. If patients are not very fit, and in the clinical judgment, that's only a clinical judgment, we don't have objective parameters, but in the clinical judgment, if these patients will get only one line of treatment and then done, because their general condition is weak, their organ function is a bit worse, I may start with TAS-102 in these patients. So I have patients who start with TAS-102 and some patients with regorafenib. And that's also recent data. We don't have biomarkers. We will never have biomarkers for TAS-102. We don't have biomarkers for regorafenib. We will probably never find biomarkers for regorafenib like we never find biomarkers for bevacizumab. So in the clinical thinking and the strategy, that are some considerations, as I would call it.
So just to pick up on a couple of points of things you were just commenting on, going back to the neutropenia with TAS-102, what's your vision of why patients who have neutropenia seem to do better? Do you think this is an on-target effect? And if you have a patient who's tolerating it totally fine, no neutropenia at all, would you escalate the dose if you could?
I never escalate the dose if a patient has no neutropenia, because we don't know whether that's really an on-target effect. It's just an interesting finding. I don't have a good explanation. There are some PK data to support these findings, but I will never increase the dose above the approved or labeled dose in these patients.
Another point about regorafenib. In the past, you've talked about the issue of cavitation that's seen sometimes with anti-angiogenics, including regorafenib. Can you comment a little bit about your experience with that, what you think's going on, and whether you consider it a prognostic variable to consider?
Well, cavitation, we see that mainly in the lungs. So that means that the center of the metastasis, of the lung metastasis in patients on regorafenib, that they become black again, and that there's a kind of a hole. We saw that in the past also in early lines, a little bit with bevacizumab, but to a much lesser extent. So other angiogenesis inhibitors give that also, so it's a class effect, but to a much lesser extent with bevacizumab or other angiogenesis inhibitors. We see that with regorafenib. It's of course an interesting finding, but it doesn't help us in our clinical practice. If you see this cavitation, it's not something that you see at the moment you start. It would be a predictive marker that could help you to decide, I will start my patient with TAS-102 or with regorafenib. That would be relevant. But in these patients, if we see after 2 or 4 months or whenever cavitation, yeah, we will say that's nice to see. We have to know that it exists so that we don't do a misinterpretation that the metastasis, if they seem a bit larger, but centrally then cavitated, the message is that we can go on in these patients. That are the patients that are benefiting. That's also a phenomenon you see sometimes in the liver with angiogenesis inhibitors, a bit more necrosis in the metastasis. If you see that, you see that also in hepatocellular carcinoma with sorafenib. That's why some people have been working on new criteria on top of the RECIST criteria with angiogenesis inhibitors. The so-called CHOI criteria is one example of published criteria in hepatocellular carcinoma.
Have you seen any complications of these cavitations, bleeding, infection?
I haven't seen any complications of these cavitations, and we've been looking at that in detail. There are a couple of papers published of the correct study with regorafenib, and then also in Leuven, we've been looking at that for the masterwork of one of my fellows. A large number of patients that we published also in clinical colorectal cancer, no complications of this cavitation. It doesn't give MOPTOA or other complications.
Could you comment a little bit on the issue of trying to move regorafenib and TAS-102 into earlier stage settings? I found this phase 2 study, the TASCO-1 trial, looking at TAS-102, bevacizumab, and capecitabine. Pretty interesting. Sounds like maybe non-toxic first-line therapy. What about that approach and other uses of these agents that's being looked at up front?
Well, I've presented at ESMO GI in June the data of the TASCO study. The TASCO study was a randomized phase 2 study, so it's not a phase 3 study, in first line. So untreated patients, where we randomized patients between capecitabine bevacizumab or TAS-102 plus bevacizumab. And these were patients that were not good candidates for a doublet cytotoxic treatment because of age, because of performance status, because of comorbidities. That were the three main categories. And in this randomized phase 2 study, the combination of TAS-102 plus bevacizumab led to a slightly better progression-free survival compared to capecitabine bevacizumab in this randomized phase 2 study. So it's interesting. There is discussion now ongoing whether there will be, I hope there will be, but to my knowledge, the decision is not yet made, of a randomized phase 3 study to see whether these interesting data of a phase 2 study, whether they hold true in a phase 3 study. If that's going to be the case, then this combination of TAS-102 plus bevacizumab is an interesting combination for early lines. If you show low toxicity and a bit better activity than capecitabine bevacizumab, there is still a group of patients who may be potential candidates for not a cytotoxic doublet plus bevacizumab that you want to treat with the fluoropyrimidine alone plus bevacizumab. In my country, it's only in a low number of patients the case that we do that. I guess in the US, it's also in a relatively low number of patients. But there are some countries where that's a bit more popular, some Asian countries, some Eastern European countries, to treat a patient with just fluoropyrimidine plus bevacizumab. And if we have a good combination, TAS-102 plus bevacizumab, that's interesting. So I do think and I do hope that we should look into that in a phase 3 study. Regorafenib, however, in earlier lines, regorafenib is a difficult drug to combine with chemotherapy. We have done a phase 2 study of FOLFOX regorafenib in first line. The results were not spectacular. It's difficult to combine. We've been thinking, trying to do different studies in the maintenance setting with regorafenib. You could think of a study of after first line FOLFOX bev, then a maintenance phase regorafenib. But the maintenance, the standard and the most optimal maintenance in this situation is a fluoropyrimidine 5-FU or capecitabine plus bevacizumab. And regorafenib will never be able to beat that. So that's, regorafenib is not a drug that you can move up front into earlier lines.
I was going to say that I would expect maybe TAS-102 plus bev to be better tolerated than capecitabine plus bev, but then I was thinking about the European thing about how capecitabine is better tolerated in Europe than the U.S. I never thought about, is there any difference? Well, TAS-102 is so well tolerated, I guess you wouldn't even see the difference. But at least in the U.S., maybe TAS-102 bev would be better tolerated.
Well, the RECORD study, which was a global study, the registration study of TAS-102 versus placebo in later lines, that included U.S. patients, European patients, and Asian patients. And we've been looking, that was a very big study, so we could look into that. And that was an obvious question that we asked, and there was no difference for TAS-102 in U.S. patients versus European versus Asian patients. So the tolerance is the same. So that's indeed a very valid remark that if TAS-102 plus bevacizumab makes it for this group of patients, in view of the better tolerance and the worse tolerance of capecitabine in U.S. patients compared to European patients, and in view of the better tolerance potentially of TAS-102, this could be an option also for U.S. patients. But of course, we need to see more data. We need to see a phase 3 study in this regard also.
So let's talk a little bit about checkpoint inhibitors in colon cancer. Can you talk a little bit, first of all, about the MSI story and where we are today with that? First, maybe beginning with the biology of MSI-high tumors and the relationship to Lynch syndrome and other genetic abnormalities.
Well, we have microsatellite instable tumors, or tumors maybe microsatellite instable, in two settings. In the setting of Lynch syndrome, hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancer syndrome, but also the sporadic MSI patients. In early stages, stage 2, you see in around 15% of tumors who are MSI. Stage 3, it's around 10%. Stage 4, it's around 4-5% of patients with stage 4 or MSI. And that's probably a bit more than half are sporadic MSIs and less than half in the setting of Lynch syndrome. We can look into MSI with different methodologies. And that's also reflected in the labeling of the checkpoint inhibitors, either with immunohistochemistry, either with marker testing. Both are acceptable. And in general, we see that immunohistochemistry is accurate in most of the studies in 95-96% of the patients. So in our setting, when selecting a potential patient for a checkpoint inhibitor, try to look into marker staining testing. If we have, however, immunohistochemistry and we know that it's performed by a good pathologist, we will trust that also. So, and that's important knowledge, this MSI story for, of course, the checkpoint inhibitors.
And can you talk a little bit about what we know today about the benefits of checkpoint inhibitors in patients with MSI high disease? We now have the approval of the combination of anti-PD-1 and anti-CTLA-4 with nivolumab, ipilimumab. Can you kind of update us on clinical research?
Yes, what we have seen is mainly data with pembrolizumab and nivolumab, initially single agent. And we see both agents a decent and a very good response rate, 30, 40, some smaller series, a little bit higher, percent of patients with an objective response. And especially what is very good and very nice is that those patients with the response is very long-lasting. I have now several patients who are more than 2 years on checkpoint inhibitors. We have to realize, and that's in Europe, they are not yet approved. Checkpoint inhibitors, Pembro and Nivo, are of course approved by the FDA. In Europe, EMA didn't grant approval for these two agents. So that's why we always have to look at clinical trials and at the availability of these agents. But there are some patients who have spectacular responses. And for instance, a patient I'm thinking of is a young lady of around 45 years old, no Lynch syndrome, so sporadic MSI, who had a lot of lymph node metastasis, mediastinum, retroperitoneum, and a couple of small liver metastasis, and then one metastasis in the left adrenal gland. Initially, she was treated with FOLFOX, BEV, and FOLFIRI cetuximab because she was RAS wild type. And then 3 years ago now, she was included in a study with pembrolizumab. We treated it for 2 years. All metastasis disappeared, with the exception of the metastasis in the adrenal gland, which after 1 year and a half treatment started to grow. So there it escaped. The other disappeared and the adrenal gland was growing. And then after 2 years, we took out, or 1 year, 9 months, we took out the metastasis in the left adrenal gland. We continued for a little bit more time, pembrolizumab. We stopped it now, 8-9 months ago, and she's still disease-free. There's no evidence of disease.
And her adrenal is just tumor, nothing unusual?
That was just tumor. We don't have a clue why this one localization grew. And this was just a normal colorectal cancer from the same tumor, identical criteria, but it was growing and the other disappeared. I don't have a clue why this is. There are a couple of other patients in other centers where the same happened. So it seems, I don't want to generalize it, but that's just an interesting case that I could share. In general, Pembro and Nivo, quite similar activity as single agent. However, recently we saw some interesting data, and at ESMO also some updates of the combination of nivolumab plus a CTLA-4 antibody ipilimumab. This combination in a non-randomized setting, so it's non-randomized data, seems to have very high activity. And it compares favorable to Nivo alone, or compares favorable cross-trial comparisons with slightly different criteria to Pembro alone. So we don't know yet today whether we should treat all patients with Nivo ipilimumab in this situation. There are for sure some patients who will need the doublet. There are questions that we should solve. What about if a patient starts with Nivo or Pembro in the first line? becomes refractory when then adding in this situation ipilimumab to the Nivo, whether that can reverse resistance. So there are many interesting questions that we could think of. And of course, in a randomized study, that would be very nice to have also some of these data of Nivo or Pembro versus the combination treatment, but we don't have yet the data. But the combination of Nivo plus EP seems to be very interesting. It's also more toxic, that's clear. So we have to find out clearly which are the patients that need the combination, because of slightly more toxicity, and we need to find out which are the patients that need only a classic checkpoint inhibitor, Nivo or EP alone.
You're a patient who had that great response with the adrenal met taken out. Did she have any toxicity or complications?
No major toxicity, a little bit grade 1 diarrhea, but no important skin toxicity, no relevant lung toxicity, no other endocrine toxicity in this patient. When we started her, she was not working anymore. And then during the treatment with Pembro, she started working again. And today, of course, she's NED, no evidence of disease. She's still working and in good shape and good condition, and so thankful. And this is not the only story. My colleagues or I could tell other stories of some of these patients where you see really these dramatic effects and these long-lasting effects. Dramatic effects not only on the tumor size, but also on the general condition of the patient, symptomatic improvement in general. You may see some toxicities, of course, with these checkpoint inhibitors. I've seen a couple of patients, colorectal cancer patients, developing diabetes, a couple of patients with thyroid abnormalities. You still see that. So you have to know that, of course. That's important. But in general, during the long-lasting treatment, in general, it works quite well for these patients. One of the big challenges and big questions will be for the future, however, in the MSI patients, to see what is the exact place, when should we give a checkpoint inhibitor? First line, or should we start in first line with chemo and then later lines? And that's the study, one of the studies that we will see next year, some results, but probably is first line MSI patients, FOLFOX, bevacizumab, or reference chemotherapy versus Pembro. That's an important study.
And of course, you know, coming out of lung cancer, one of the questions would be, what about chemo plus checkpoint inhibitor? Is that being looked at first line?
There are some small series ongoing, but no data are available. There is also a study in the adjuvant setting, stage 3, that is running right now with FOLFOX plus or minus atezolizumab in stage 3 colon cancer. So in the adjuvant setting with chemo plus or minus a checkpoint inhibitor. So there are many different questions in this that we have to answer.
But now this is adjuvant MSI?
Yes, that's a study that is running in the US.
Wow.
FOLFOX plus or minus atezolizumab, the PD-L antibody in MSI stage 3 colon cancer.
That's really great.
That's running. But that will take several years, of course, before we will see the results of this study. That's a relatively large study. Adjuvant setting results, events, it will take some time, and all patients get FOLFOX in this. So that's chemo plus or minus a checkpoint inhibitor. So there is some activity ongoing also here.
Really interesting. You know, of course, the issue of combined PD-1 and anti-CTLA-4 is being obviously a big part of melanoma, lung cancer, you're seeing studies in it. And, you know, in terms of the issue of complication, it kind of sounds like from what I'm hearing that a lot of this has to do with the IPI or the anti-CTLA-4. And you know, people have talked a lot about dosing. What do we know about, you know, the dosing in this combination?
We didn't figure it out completely. What is clear is that EP is usually given for short duration, and potentially the lower dose may also be an option in this, because that's clear. The combination of Nivo plus EP is more toxic than Nivo alone. That's clear. For me, it's not yet clear today what will be at the long term the recommended dose.
Another issue that you hear in other tumors, again, lung and melanoma particularly, is tumor mutation burden and benefit from this combination, and of course, PD-L1 level. What do we know about that with MSI-high colorectal cancer?
We don't expect that this will be good parameters, good predictive markers in colorectal cancer. The mutation load is relatively low in colorectal cancer. So looking at the total mutational burden, the TMB in colorectal cancer is probably not going to help us so far. Because if you look at the mutational load, the mutational burden in different cancers, colorectal cancer is relatively low. I do expect that if we go in, for instance, metastatic advanced gastric cancer, their total mutational burden on top of some other markers, EBV and PDL, may help us to distinguish which patients do benefit. But in colorectal cancer, we don't have data that it's useful, and PDL staining doesn't seem to be useful neither in colorectal cancer.
I thought that the MSI-high tumors were high mutational load.
They have indeed a bit higher mutation load than the MSS tumors. That's correct. But the question was, can TMB, total mutational burden, help us on top of MSI, or in the MSS patients, help us to take out some of the MSS patients with a relatively high mutational burden? No. So if you look in MSI status and MSS MSI status, that's the best predictive marker in colorectal cancer. TMB will not help us on top of MSI status.
What is your vision, you know, sort of biologically about why it is as MSI high tumors do respond, you know, so well to checkpoint inhibitors?
Well, the mutational burden, the inflammation, if you look in the biopsies of Lynch syndrome, you see a lot of inflammation also. Some pathologists, sometimes before having results available of the MSI status, can give the suggestion, this is a quite inflamed tumor. There are a lot of lymphocytes in the tumor. And then even say, yeah, is this not a Lynch syndrome? So there is clearly more inflammation in these tumors ongoing. And that's why these tumors are a bit more hot, better candidates for immuno-oncology agents, for checkpoint inhibitors. And that was the whole rationale, to try to make MSS tumors also more hot, more inflamed, with, according to some preclinical data, with MEK inhibition in combination with a checkpoint inhibitor. There were some preclinical data that the tumors, some tumors at least, may become a bit more inflamed in this setting. The clinical trial, however, of MEK inhibitor cobimetinib plus atezolizumab in this MSS tumors did not lead to any benefit compared to regorafenib or compared to checkpoint inhibitor alone. So let's say that these preclinical data did not translate in a phase 3 data in a new treatment option for patients.
Any other strategies, you know, to try to see whether or not, you know, checkpoint inhibitors could be used in MS stable disease, you know, in other cancers, there's all kinds of combinations. They're combining almost every novel agent you can think of. Anything that's being done with MS-stable colorectal cancer that you're excited about?
Well, we have seen one study right now with the MEK inhibitor as cobimetinib plus atezolizumab. There are still some other studies ongoing. It's not because one study didn't make it. With some other MEK inhibitors, there are some other studies ongoing in this situation, ongoing and or planned. So that may be interesting to look at. There are some studies also ongoing with, for instance, a checkpoint inhibitor, PD antibody plus a CTLA4 antibody plus a MEK inhibitor. That's an ongoing project. And then we will have to look into what is ongoing also in other tumors. We start now even with a study with CAR T cells in colorectal cancer. Whether that's going to be successful, nobody knows. But there are different approaches ongoing in colorectal cancer, also with immune therapies.
You know, I got to say, you know, we don't talk too much about the issue of approvals and, you know, we kind of stick to the clinical science, but it is kind of striking that checkpoint inhibitors are not approved in Europe for MSI high tumors. You know, listening to a case, I've heard plenty of cases like that. It must be very frustrating to be in that situation. What about the UK? Is it approved there?
No, the UK is still in Europe today, although the Brexit
That's
is
right, yeah.
Closer. The UK is still in Europe. And EMA, the European Medicinal Agency, today is still based in the UK. They will move to Amsterdam in the near future once UK is out of Europe. But in the UK, no, these checkpoint inhibitors are not approved. However, in some countries, you can get them paid because the data are so strong. And this is really a mistake by EMA that they didn't approve the data are so strong. And they were asking for larger series or randomized data sets. All experts completely agree in this situation that this is a mistake, that this should not happen anymore. The data are so strong in this group of patients with MSI tumors, metastatic colorectal cancer.
But just for my own advocation, though, doesn't the UK, the NICE system, is that separate from the European approval system? Or
NICE system is a system, there is first always European approval. And then NICE is UK-based system, who takes into account also some economic aspects, who does a new evaluation on the, like a little bit the ESMO scales of magnitude of benefit,
right,
the ASCO scales of magnitude of benefit.
So it's like layered on top of the approvals.
On top of approvals, yes.
Interesting.
So if a drug is not approved by EMA, it will not make it through NICE at the moment, as long as UK is in Europe.
That's interesting, you know, because again, you know, to me, you don't have to hear too many stories like that to, you know, want to use a drug. But I was flashing on HCC, and I knew you treat HCC, and I hear stories like that in HCC. Are checkpoint inhibitors approved by EMA for HCC?
No, they are not yet approved in this. We hope it will come. I expect it will come in the future, but they're not yet approved.
Just out of curiosity, have you seen patients with HCC who had these, you know, great responses, kind of like your patient you were just describing?
Yes, but in HCC, we are limited to clinical trials. We have seen some patients. I see a patient now in front of me who is a man between 65 and 70 years, pre-treated, and he's now for 1 year and a half on a checkpoint inhibitor, and he does very well. He's again more active than he was before, and in his first line he was treated with sorafenib, and then he went in second line on checkpoint inhibitors. Yes, we see that, but a little bit less widely used today because of the labeling, but that's going to come. I hope we will make it in the near future also.
Any other agents or strategies in metastatic colorectal cancer that we haven't talked about today that you want to comment on?
There's, of course, the small group of alterations, POLE, POLD, that may benefit from checkpoint inhibitors, TRK alterations that may benefit in a recent publication from a TRK inhibitor. In the recent publication in a basket trial, recent publication in New England Journal of Medicine with a TRK inhibitor, there were a couple of colorectal cancer patients also. So that's for small subgroup of patients. We have seen the data of the phase one with CA-TCB bispecific antibody. The efficacy data of CA-TCB in combination with atezolimab in the phase one study, that was impressive in colorectal cancer patients. That was presented at ASCO, but there was clearly some toxicity in this situation, and we're now rethinking the further development programs with this drug. But this bispecific antibody, that seems to be, especially in combination with the checkpoint inhibitor, according to a presentation by Dr. Tabernero at ASCO, in a small number of patients, a relatively low number of patients, but the results were quite impressive.
That's really interesting. So bispecific antibody like blinatumomab and ALL?
The targets are different. It's CD3 as a target and as well CA as a target. So the targets are different, but it's a bispecific antibody that binds to two different targets, CD3 and CA in this situation.
But it's an immunotherapy.
It's an immunotherapy, and then it's combined further also. There was a cohort, as according to Josep Tabernero's presentation, a cohort of patients who received CA-TCB alone and a cohort of patients who received CA-TCB plus a checkpoint inhibitor, atezolimab, PD-L antibody. And especially the patients with the combination, they did clearly better than patients also with CA-TCB alone. It's interesting, there was, as was reported at ASCO, quite some toxicity, so that's being sorted out right now. And we need, of course, larger studies, and there are plans in colorectal cancer in pancreatic cancer, different tumor types that do express CEA, because that's an important target for this bispecific antibody.
That's really interesting. With the, I know it's a totally different target, but you know, I know with the blinatumomab, they saw cytokine release, they saw a neurologic, it was like a CAR T type syndrome. Is that what they see here?
That's a kind of, some of the side effects are acute toxicity, not completely the same as a cytokine release syndrome, but with some similarities, and that's what is being sorted out also, correct.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Van Cutsem. Thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Colorectal Cancer Update.